A podcast of the cinema.
What's your name?
I'm Alonzo Duralde. I am...
I think you sound a little too happy about that.
I'm Alonzo Duralde.
Good. Better.
Okay.
Better.
I'm the co-host of this podcast and
everyone
also...
just calm down.
Okay, fine. I also co-host the Who Shot Ya and Breakfast All Day podcasts. I'm the film reviews editor at The Wrap and you are...
Dave White. I, too, am a film critic. I write for The Wrap. And mostly, I'm just here making dinner today is all. That's for the first time in a week.
Yes.
I haven't cooked a thing in a week. Because it's just been too hurt in my back for that sort of thing. All the normal activities of a
human being?
The cook of a great house. The bending, the stooping, the checking the oven to see what the level of the cake is, the chopping, the reaching.
You have, yes, you've been Mrs. Patmore off getting eye surgery, and I've had to be Daisy.
Yes, yes. But I will never yell at you as much as she yells at Daisy.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to hold you to
about
that.
This anyway. You're very stressed out in the kitchen. I don't want you.
It's true.
Yeah.
I have no chill when it comes time to be the cook.
The only cooking I did this week was using that Instant Pot for the first time and kind of failing. Pot doesn't really count as cooking because you're just throwing things in it and. Like,
I'm sure Instant Pot owners everywhere would beg to differ that it doesn't count. That it doesn't count as cooking.
No, you're not doing anything. You're just letting it do all the things.
Oh, you are. You're just digging yourself a hole now.
No, I'm not.
Well, you know, I think.
You chopped an onion to put into the Instant Pot.
Given that you
and then all your other items, and then you just let it.
Given
cook
that
for 5 minutes,
did it wrong, boom. I don't think you're in any position to judge others.
Listen, even if I had done it right and everything had come out right, it still would have involved 1 minute of prep, which is not cooking.
Look.
The machine is doing that.
Okay, so...
I'm fine with the machine doing it.
Oh, look at you with your newfangled oven. Why can't you cook over an open fire like a real chef? Where's your steel egg spoon? Sheesh. Anyway, for more of that discussion...
No. This is not an ad. We're not doing a spot. We're not doing a bit.
I just people want to know. They want to hear more food talk.
They can talk. We'll discuss that later.
Okay, fine.
Later.
Fine.
I'm just talking about it's Sunday afternoon. We're doing this podcast. I'm always making dinner. I had this big idea. Oh, yeah. We're going to have Sunday dinner again for the first time in a couple of weeks. And I'm going to get right back in there. And I'm going to cook things. And I'm going to bake a cake.
Because you can't wait to re-injure yourself.
I get
the way you did by doing dishes.
I sit down this morning and I'm looking at the cake cookbook.
Uh-huh.
I'm looking at the Meta Heater cake cookbook.
Mm-hmm.
Meta Heater's cakes.
Yes. Meta Heater, who we lost recently.
And the, I'm looking up all the different kinds of chocolate cakes. I really want to make a chocolate cake. Mm-hmm. And they all sounded so good that I got overwhelmed and kind of upset.
You had
that moment of
it's not Stendhal syndrome. There's some sort of term for this where you're overwhelmed by choices and beauty.
That's exactly what it was, and I had that moment.
You had chocolate Stendhal syndrome.
And I thought, no, that's not Stendhal syndrome.
Okay,
I don't think it is anyway.
No, that's something else.
We have to go look that up.
Stendhal syndrome.
We both used to know.
Stendhal syndrome is where you're like so overcome by a work of art that you're rendered like speechless or blind or something.
Someone out there was going, "Those guys are idiots," and I wish I could tell them what Stendhal syndrome is right now because it's totally
they're saying it wrong
on the top of my head, and they're saying it wrong. In any case.
You're like the dog in the Devo song, Freedom of Choice.
No, you know what I am?
You had two bones, and you went in circles.
I'll tell you what dog I'm like. I'm like Kevin Costner as that dog in the car movie who talks like Foghorn Leghorn, at least when I do the impersonation.
God.
Do you know why? Because I am actually making dinner.
Oh, I thought you said you are actually Foghorn Leghorn.
I am actually making dinner. I'm just not making a cake.
Okay.
That was a little too ambitious. Mm-hmm. The dinner's just going to be a stovetop dinner.
Okay.
It's going to be, I'm using the food processor to chop things up. Yes,
please don't destroy your back
but
again.
But what I'm making is chicken fricassee.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that a Foghorn Leghorn recipe or is it not? It is.
It is definitely a Looney Tunes. Boy. Like somebody there.
Boy.
Somebody had the word fricassee on the list of words that are funny.
Words. Funny.
Yes. I don't know if it was Tex Avery or Chuck Jones.
I'm making the chicken
somebody
fricassee.
Had like fricassee and Hassenpfeffer.
Yes.
Pismo Beach.
Are you listening to this podcast for the very first time and you have no idea what's going on already? Do you think, I thought they were film critics.
I came here for the hot Joker takes.
We're going to give you our hot Joker take. First, my husband here will tell you his hot Joker take because he's been not sitting on it since Venice.
No,
you wanted to hear his hot Joker take.
I wrote a review of it like a month and a half ago.
He went to the Venice Film Festival where they had the world premiere and he saw it there.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote a review.
Yes.
And people were mad about it. People angry.
Apparently
everybody
so.
Angry at you.
Everyone
is angry.
I'm sure. Look, Stephanie Zacharek apparently is getting it much worse than me because, you know.
What do you know?
A woman had an opinion about a comic book
movie. What do you
movie.
Think about that?
How dare she? So I'm not even going to complain about that.
Every time one of these damn movies comes out, I think, poor every female film critic.
Yeah.
Because they're going to get nastiest responses.
And it's like, you know, Matt Seitz was talking on Twitter about how, you know, this is a movie that won the Golden Lion at Venice, is
right.
making money, is fresh on the tomato meter.
It's fresh.
But that's not enough.
Not enough.
It's got to be, everybody has
Look,
to.
They are underdogs.
Well.
And they need.
Yes.
They need to win.
I want to
Let
read.
Let these underdogs win. They're the bad news bears of film fans. Can't they ever get a break?
Speaking of.
Can't someone ever make a movie for them?
Speaking of Twitter,
I
wanted to share this thread from Mark Harris from just a couple hours ago where he says, congratulations to Joker, a well-funded studio movie with an eight-figure marketing campaign and a 4,000-plus screen opening on its gigantic come-from-behind underdog little guy victory over mildly dissenting tweets. Really, it's like the end of Rocky. Well, Rocky 2. Because never forget, they tried to kill this movie by saying things like, I don't think I want to see it, and it's not for me, and pass, and other Holocaust cancel culture hate speech. They couldn't! All caps with clapping emoji. In conclusion, best picture, Joker. Best director, Joker guy. Best actor, Q Honker Phoenix. Best supporting actress, that chick didn't catch her name. Onward! So, yeah, we're having a culture war for no apparent reason.
I'm not.
Because people are idiots.
I'm not in any culture war.
And I'm not saying you're an idiot if you like this movie. I'm saying you're an idiot if you are offended that someone else doesn't.
I'm in a war of...
attrition?
I'm in the fricassee war.
Well,
and I'm going
yes.
to win.
Yeah.
I'm in the love war.
I look forward to your
I'm
letters.
Already winning.
Letters from the front of the fricassee war. My beloved. These carrots aren't going to chop themselves.
They aren't. The Cuisinart. The word processor. The food processor. Just did that. Well, why don't we just get into it?
Let's
talk about the Joker.
Now, you're minutes out of it, so you start.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, okay. So, Joaquin Phoenix plays...
Arthur Fleck.
I knew the last name was Fleck.
Not Bela, Arthur.
He is a clown. He works as a clown in New York, Gotham City.
Mm-hmm.
See, here's my problem. I'm already going to interrupt myself. I cannot be relied upon to deliver real Batman canon factually because I barely know any of it, even after all these movies from the Tim Burton Batman forward.
Oh, don't front like you haven't seen the 1968.
Okay, yeah, true. True. The TV show.
Yes.
The greatest and the best Joker. Really. So if I get everything wrong, then blame my comic book nerd spouse for making me tell you the plot synopsis.
Dave, this movie is beyond the mere DC universe.
Is it?
It is. It is.
Is I mean, okay, be serious with me right now.
No,
is it? You're being goofy right now.
No, I am being goofy. It is, I think, intended to. It has enough Batman canon for people to go, ooh, a name I know. But okay. I think that director Todd Phillips feels like he is transcending.
I see.
The All mere right. comic book movie.
Okay, so he works as a clown. He has an unnamed mental illness. He also has a neurological disorder that makes him laugh anytime. Yeah. A form of, you know, a Tourette's-like
a tic
situation where he is laughing uncontrollably when he doesn't want to be laughing.
Right.
The film, you know, lets you know this a lot by playing songs like Smile, Though Your Heart Is Breaking, mm. and Put On a Happy Face, and whatever else. Lots of, oh, That's Life. Old big band kind of standard songs about
Rat Packy stuff, yeah.
smiling and being happy and stuff like that. Juxtaposition.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And he lives with his mother, played by Frances Conroy from 6 Feet Under.
Mm-hmm.
He takes care of her, tends to her. And she is constantly telling him that she needs to send letters to Bruce Wayne's father. What's his name?
Thomas Wayne.
Thomas Wayne, billionaire. Billionaire.
Yeah. Big muckety muck of Gotham.
In stately Wayne Manor.
Yes.
Oh, by the way. Digression. last week, when our beloved Nayland Blake was in town.
Mm-hmm.
For their 30-plus year
It's career. A 30th anniversary career retrospective.
30 years.
At ICA.
Not 30-plus. 30 yeah. years. Career retrospective at the ICA. Took a lift over here to hang out for a bit. Walked in and said, I never knew you lived in a manor. I'm like, what? They say the name of your building is Harper Manor. We live in an apartment building. That has a name. In Los Angeles, a lot of mid-century apartment buildings were given names.
Yes.
And they were written on the front of the building in, you know.
Some sort of script.
Yeah. And ours is called Harper Manor, and I don't even think about it anymore.
Well, I had a joke when the first apartment I lived in Los Angeles with Robert Abeley.
Yeah.
There was a sign out front, all because there's always one for rent, and there was always right. a sign that said, like, that listed all these amenities, and it said spacious apartments.
Yes.
So whenever somebody would ask, I'd say, oh, yes, I live in the spacious apartments.
So, anyway, I said to Nayland, well, we'll be sure to say that on the podcast that we're broadcasting live.
From stately
Harper Manor. Yes. Where was I going with this?
Oh, Thomas Wayne.
Thomas Wayne. Oh, by the way, we're about to start spoiling things, right?
I wasn't sure how you wanted to
do
this.
We sort of don't really have a choice if we're going to really talk about this and get into what we are not happy with.
Okay, so if you were not part of this film's record-breaking opening weekend, maybe skip ahead about 20 minutes.
Or maybe pause this. Decide if you're going to go see this film.
Yes.
Then go see this film.
Or not.
Or not.
And then listen to the rest of this.
Go, like I did, to a nice morning screening. Where, you know, they won't be screening people for guns, or maybe they're doing. How long are they going to be doing that in the multiplexes?
How long
are they going to screen people for guns?
I don't know. And they're not doing it in all the multiplexes.
They're not.
Did they do it at yours?
No, because it was the AMC Sunset 5 in West Hollywood.
Okay, well,
at 11 a.m. on a Sunday morning.
Then they're not doing it at all the multiplexes.
Also, you have to show your ID, and it's a 21 and up theater.
Yes.
Because they sell booze no matter what time of day it is.
I don't know what I'm sure it differs from chain to chain, like what right. they're doing in which locations. And I don't know.
Anyway,
so now we're going to start spoiling things.
We're going to start spoiling things, so if you're not down, give it a pause.
Yeah.
But I mean, how many spoilers are there in a movie about the Joker's origins?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the funny thing about the comics is that...
Do the comics give us the Joker's origins?
The whole point was that it was constantly in flux and that it was never to be trusted. So, like,
what do you mean by that?
Like, they would give us various different ones over the years.
Right.
And you were never... And they were always being told by him, and he was always very much an unreliable narrator.
Right.
So part of the mystique of the character...
Like life itself?
God. Thanks for bringing that memory back. So the point in the comics was that he was always this sort of enigmatic figure that there were stabs at origin stories, but we weren't ever meant to take any of them particularly seriously. The part of the appeal of the character was we didn't know where he came from. So in this version, I mean, I don't even, that's the thing. It's like, it's not even a thing where like he falls into a vat of, you know, playing card chemicals or whatever, you know, it's just that he sort of becomes.
He's beaten down by life.
Yes.
People
literally and figuratively
physically attack him every chance they can. He lives in a world that is quite often the construction of his own fantasies.
Right.
And the film shows you interactions that later it doubles back on and lets you know, oh yeah, that never happened.
Right.
That was in his head.
This is Gotham City as like mid-70s New York City. Like there's a garbage strike.
Right. That's why I keep saying, oh, it's just New York.
Yeah.
Gotham's always New York. Yeah, there's a garbage strike. There is a TV late night talk show host that he's obsessed with.
Yes.
Very Winky Winky, played by
Robert De Niro.
Because who was the star of Taxi Driver, which this film borrows from, and also the star of The King of Comedy, which this film borrows from.
Yes. My original headline for the rap that they didn't let me use was, Joaquin Phoenix is the Travis Bickle of Rupert Pumpkins.
Right. So, as life goes on and things get worse and worse, and he finds out that his mother is not the person he thought she was...
Yeah.
And his father is not the person he thought it was. And can we just say it? We're spoiling the film.
Sure.
His mother tells him via a letter that he finds that she's going to send to Thomas Wayne, that Thomas Wayne is the Joker's father. Now, we also learned that the mother has been in psychiatric hospitals herself. And that this might not be true.
Yeah, which is, it's this weird thing of either it's not true, which would make a lot of sense. But on the other hand, because Thomas Wayne is so rich and powerful and could manipulate
anything he wanted,
paperwork and having people put away in institutions if they were a problem and all that kind of stuff, then maybe it is true, in which case then we're dealing with a Austin Powers situation in which
right.
the Batman and Joker are half brothers.
Right. Was that ever part of the comic books?
No.
No, never.
Never.
Because it's not a bad idea.
I mean, I guess not, but it's also a thing where it's also giving us a universe in which the Joker has got a good 25 years on Bruce Wayne.
Right.
Which, you know, is its own thing. But that's, as we were saying on Breakfast All Day, it's kind of the Gotham syndrome.
Well, Joaquin Phoenix is like 45 years old, so
right.
But he's got about 35 years.
Well, I mean, if we're being generous and saying he's playing younger, you know.
Yeah.
But like, you know, like on the TV show Gotham, you have like 13-year-old Bruce Wayne, but grown-ass like Oswald Cobblepot and Edward Nygma and all these people who would later become like the Batman Rogues Gallery. And it's like, you know, yes, you had a Selina Kyle and a Poison Ivy who were about his age, but otherwise everybody seemed way older. And I don't know. It's just a weird dramatic conceit. But not even really part of, not even on the list of this film's actual problems. We're just sort of getting into the weeds.
No, we're just talking about the plot here. Right now. Yeah. Then there is also a
Thomas Wayne makes a comment on television
about
the have-nots basically being clowns.
Yes,
which foments this sort of Occupy style,
yeah,
like revolt against the wealthy with people wearing clown masks,
and they wear the clown masks because Joaquin Phoenix has murdered 3 Wall Street executives, right, on a subway.
Or whatever Gotham's Wall Street is.
Because they harass a woman riding on the subway, and then they...
they taunt him by singing
all
the verses of Send in the Clowns.
It's fascinating. And then they physically assault him.
Yes.
And in response, he shoots all 3 of them dead.
Yes. Now...
So then comes this, you know, social movement of riots and protests with people wearing clown masks and everybody carrying signs that say, kill the rich. Not eat them in that, you know, cleverly facetious way.
Right.
Not tax them, which is ultimately what you really want to do.
No.
But kill them. So that, by that logic, really, what you're thinking is, okay, well, yes, oh yes, kill them so that their wealth goes to their heirs.
Who will dress up as bats, you know.
Or who will just keep it.
Yes, right. It doesn't really get you anywhere.
No one's life is going to be bettered by killing them.
Rich, did you read... you haven't read any reviews, I guess, because you were holding up.
No, not even yours.
Okay, no, that's fine. Richard Brody in The New Yorker had an interesting point where he says that the movie is sort of exploitative of real life New York incidents. Like at the beginning of the film when he's holding a sign outside of a store and a group of Latino kids like steal it and then beat him in an alleyway.
They're wilding.
Exactly.
Yes.
It's meant to recall the Central Park Five.
Yes.
And then the subway shooting, of course, is Bernard Goetz.
Yes.
You know, and again, it's like, what does the movie think of these things? What does it want us to think about these things?
The movie believes in exactly what the Joker believes in. The movie believes in nothing.
Mm.
So now let's talk about this movie that is a big mess. This movie does believe in nothing.
Yeah. In my review in the rap that you didn't read, I made the point.
I can't do everything.
No, I totally get it. And I get not reading reviews of a movie that you know you're going to have to see.
Also, I don't like to read reviews.
No,
I totally. Yeah.
The movie throws in so much stuff that I was imagining, like, okay, this part I could see, like, Laura Ingraham really, like, latching onto. And then this other part I could see, like, some sort of progressive pundit getting onto.
Yes.
And it's sort of like, this movie, it wants all the cakes and to eat all of them. And so, ultimately, it's not saying anything because it's saying everything at the same time.
I believe, obviously, this is not a mistake. This is intentional.
Yes.
On the part of Todd Phillips. He co-wrote the script. He wants to throw all of the outrage into one pile and set it on fire because he doesn't have to think about any of it.
Right. So this is where Occupy and the Tea Party basically become the same thing.
Yes. It is a film that is intentionally muddling its political ideas because it wants you to think that it
has them.
Has them and also has none.
Hmm.
So I would like it if he would stop being an idiot. Because when you are going to, you know, make a big franchise film like this.
Well, they're currently claiming it's a standalone.
It's a standalone?
But
okay.
Like I said, they're currently claiming.
Well, they always say that.
It had a very big opening weekend.
Makes a lot of money, so they want it. They want to do another one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying you have to come down on the side of, you know, good, decent, left-leaning politics
mm-hmm.
versus crappy, destructive, right-wing politics. Oh, I have a point of view. What I'm saying is the film should have a point of view.
Yes.
Because if the film's only point of view is that this is what the world does to people with mental illness, he doesn't even get that right in a way that makes any sense. Because the laughing situation is not a mental illness. It's sort of a neurological condition.
Yeah. It's dropped after Act One.
We never... No. He keeps doing it.
I guess,
He keeps doing it. Trust me. I just got out of the film.
But never in such an awkward way as in Act One where he has to, like, hand the card to somebody to explain what's going on.
No, he does that, like, more than once in the film.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Scratch that, then.
So, it's been years since you've seen this
movie. I've seen a lot of films between now and then.
I'm fresh.
Okay.
I'm fresh.
I defer to your...
All right. They never discuss what sort of mental illness this is. It is...
It's the kind of movie where he's taking like 7 different meds at the same time.
Yes, but we don't know what they are.
We don't know what they are.
And listen, it's a comic book movie, so it's not required to obey the laws of reality all the time.
Mm-hmm.
However, filmmakers will play fast and loose with mental illness every chance they get.
Oh yeah.
We're in the part of film history where movies like Christine that came out mm-hmm. what, 2 years ago?
2016.
3 years ago. Movies like Christine are not only true stories, but they're films about mental illness.
Right.
They're not... The films that we have in the world are if they have characters who have mental health challenges, they are not, organic to the plot. Films that are... That's what the movie's about.
Or they're a plot. Right, okay. Sorry.
Christine is about this.
Correct.
All right.
Other movies would use that sort of thing as a plot device.
And this is a plot device. Right. This is a... I hesitate to even say that it's a character study about a person with mental illness because it doesn't really care about his character. It just wants you to take you from point A to point B to point C.
Mm-hmm.
All you're waiting around to happen is for him to get real wild and murderous.
Mm-hmm.
And he does at the end. It is an intentionally messy, muddled thing that someone should have stopped and said, pick something.
Right.
Pick something. Because if your critique is everybody's a mess and terrible and no one's right, and
and burn it all down.
If you're angry about something, then you're just a sucker, you know?
Yeah.
Because they actually do a terrible thing to him mid-movie by taking away all of his health care benefits and, you know, his medication and his social worker, anything that might have kept him functioning in the world.
Stable, yeah.
Mostly stably, you know. It is very, you know, very much, there's a very big, you know, pointed moment where the government's taking this away.
Right.
And then the very... protest movement that springs from this, from the shutting down of social services to, you know, the oligarchy, you know, ruining everyone's life. The movie decides that those people are crackpots.
Yes, barbarians.
Violent barbarians who are out to riot and burn things down and attacking cops.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Like, and the progressive pundit would get onto the...
It pulls you in one direction and it pulls you in another and says, oh, did you really have feelings about something? Well, you're a fool.
Yeah.
That's really what it's doing. So... It's gorgeous.
I was going to say, let's talk about what you liked.
It's gorgeous.
It is shot beautifully. It also takes so many visual cues from those Scorsese films as well, and I think does something with them.
It wants so badly to be an art film.
Mm.
And it wants it so badly that it repeats itself
right
visually again and again. About the third or fourth time that you see him in sort of long shot, you know, dancing up something or jumping up something, you know, undulating his body around.
And those are discrete moments in the film that I think are effective.
They are.
And do something.
How many times do I need to be shown this
exactly
to get the point across?
Lawrence Scherr, by the way, is the... cinematographer. He did Hangover for Todd Phillips, and he also shot Godzilla King of the Monsters and Garden State.
It has an unusual relationship with people of color.
How so?
In that it, again, uses people of color for its own ends.
Well,
and
the Zazie Beetz character is, I think, clearly meant to inspire memories of the Diane Abbott character in King of Comedy.
But I'm talking about initial setups.
Okay.
Where his encounters with people of color are brutal and rough.
True.
And then it throws in a love interest who is black.
Right.
And it is doing the same thing with race that it's doing with, you know, ideas of right and wrong and ideas of good and bad.
Mm.
He got a little bit of an axe to grind about comedy. Just a little bit. We get that at the end.
Yeah.
In a scene that is so ludicrous and so crappishly written.
I would love to know what Marc Maron thinks about this final film.
I don't know.
Now that he's in it.
I don't know. Yeah. Well, he's got a small part.
Yes.
He had no control over anything.
Yeah. No, I'm sure it's like, oh, I'm in a scene with De Niro? Great, I'm in.
Joaquin Phoenix's performance is pretty great. And he is doing, I think, a bit of an extension, a more extreme and exaggerated extension of his performance in You're Never Really Here.
Yeah, no, that's an easy... there's definitely connective tissue.
Go on.
I would say I don't love what he does as a general rule, but I think he commits to what he does. And he's doing exactly what the film wants him to do. So, like, I respect the work. It's not a kind of acting that I respond to.
The most pleasure I derived was from his freaky, skinny Christian Bale in The Machinist
right.
body, sort of dancing and writhing and
undulating. Yeah. Physical stuff,
in his
absolutely.
Wet underpants. And it's like everything in this movie is so
skeevy,
ugly, and just uncomfortable and terrible. And there's a slapstick quality, obviously, to his physical performance. He's constantly falling down, bumping into things, you know, intentionally smashing his head into stuff. They show you footage of Charlie Chaplin mid-film to remind you that's what Joaquin Phoenix is trying to do right here. He's giving you slapstick, but it's, you know, meant to be heartbreak slapstick. And
like Chaplin.
I wish I didn't see all the seams here. Because when I rode down in the elevator from the theater to the parking garage, every single other person in the elevator with me had just seen the same film.
Right.
We all filed out of the movie theater into the elevator and went down. And everyone was talking. Like, I just sat there and listened. But, you know, bro, that movie was intense, bro. Seriously, that's a quote. That's a real quote from real dudes.
Well, I'll say if all you ever go see is other comic book movies,
okay,
next to other comic book movies, this one might fool you into thinking that you have just seen something serious.
Yeah. It thinks it's serious.
Oh, boy, howdy.
I want Todd Phillips to be a smarter, more human director. Because I don't think he's got his grasp on humanity.
Do you remember War Dogs?
Yes.
A movie that we're all pretending never happened because right. This is supposed to be his big leap out of comedy.
Right.
War Dogs was supposed to be sort of serious.
Right.
And it was terrible.
Yeah.
And I don't think his comedies are all that great either, frankly, the ones I've seen. I haven't seen all of them. So I
was able to give the Hangover films the benefit of the doubt.
All three of them?
No, the last one was abominable. But okay. The first two, I remember walking out of them thinking, all right, this person's not an idiot. Like, Todd Phillips is not an idiot. He made a great documentary about G.G. Allen. Mm-hmm. He knows extreme behavior when he sees it.
Right.
Right. So I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt that he knows that these characters are absolutely reprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
Not so sure anymore if he knows or cares if those characters are reprehensible.
Right. I never gave him that benefit of the doubt, so this just feels like more of a piece. And I at least have the benefit of having disliked Joker before the wave of ridiculous Todd Phillips interviews.
Oh yeah, yeah.
For the last week, where he's complained about woke culture.
Oh yeah,
art should be complicated.
Right.
Thank you, sir.
I agree. It should be complicated.
And what a bold stance.
But more than that, it should be complex. And when you aren't,
yeah.
When it's not, you kind of screwed your pooch there.
Yeah.
I don't understand how this won the top award at the Venice Film Festival.
Me neither.
Other than that, it looks really good.
If I ever meet Lucretia Martel, that's the first question.
Oh, do you think? Well, but do you think that was she the jury?
She was the chair.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean it was her choice.
No, I know. Yeah. But all the more, if it wasn't, all the more reason for her to be like, well, let me tell you.
This is an ad for Ovid.
Yes, it is.
Ovid.tv, OVID.tv. They emailed us this week. They said, we want you to do more ads. We said, great. Send us ad copy.
We would love that.
They didn't send us any ad copy.
They did not.
So here we are. Winging it.
But they love it when we wing it, so it's okay.
I, frankly, all I need from them is the specifics of what, like...
They're really pushing.
...special they've got going on.
Because it's all good.
Or what they want emphasized this week, because we've had Ovid even before we were on the take from them.
True.
I'll tell you a secret. We ain't getting no Marvel money. We're getting Ovid money.
Yes.
Pay us electric bill level amounts. And we're grateful.
We are.
We love an advertiser.
And we love an advertiser that we use anyway.
We love an advertiser that we already love.
Yes.
Right. And so the thing about Ovid is that it's a streaming service that costs you $3.50 per month for the first 3 months.
We'll get to that.
We'll get to that in a minute. But what they are is
an amalgam.
The left hand of the right hand of the Criterion Collection.
Sure.
The Criterion Channel has all that good stuff that you like. And these folks have...
all the good stuff that you might not know exists.
Deep cut art house that you want.
Yes.
New things they have as of what? This week or October?
This week.
Tokyo Fiancé.
Mm-hmm.
Last Cab to Darwin. Magical Girl. What does Pedro Almodovar say about Magical Girl?
He calls it, I think, the first Spanish cinema revelation of the century.
Oh. and a film called Mountain that I have not seen yet. But I'm stoked for Magical Girl.
Yeah.
If Almodovar is into it.
I know. That's a blurb.
But what I'm really into right now on Ovid, since I'm going off on my own thing here.
Look out, everybody.
They have a bunch of Jean Roche
films. Okay.
Jean Roche was one of the co-directors of Chronicle of a Summer,
mm-hmm.
one of the best movies. And
the movie that we that arguably began the contemporary documentary.
Cinema Verite in the 1960s. Yeah. If you've never seen Chronicle of a Summer, you could probably go to the Criterion Channel. but all the other Jean Roche movies
is on Ovid.
Are on Ovid right now. Jaguar. A documentary about him called Jean Roche, the Adventurous Filmmaker. Little by Little, Mammy Water, Moi, Un Noir, The Human Pyramid, The Lion Hunters, The Mad Masters, The Punishment. This is very exciting. This man made 700 films before he died. Not that many. But just a key figure in the breakthrough of the French New Wave.
Ovid is basically like the Avengers of all the really cool small distributors.
Yeah, yes.
They got their acts together, yeah. And it's like...
Everybody banded together.
It's Grasshopper Films and Bullfrog Films and Women Make Movies and Kinstim and Icarus, yeah. And, you know, a whole bunch of others.
And ones we're forgetting.
Yes.
Sorry.
Apologies.
Tell them the deal. Tell them what's the deal they get.
A sweet, sweet deal for Linoleum Knife listeners. If you sign up with the code name podcast before October 25th, you get 50% off your first 3 months of Ovid TV. And that's ovid.tv. O-V as in Victor, I-D as in David.tv. And they will get you squared away for 3 months at 50% off just by using the code word podcast.
All right. Speaking of Pedro Almodovar, you saw Pain and Glory, but I haven't.
Correct.
So you're going to wait for me.
Yes.
We're going to go see it this week. Yes. You're going to go see it again.
Yes.
Because you like it that much. And I can't wait. And we're going to pick a theater that doesn't hurt my back.
Is there such a thing?
I don't know. We'll find out.
Okay.
And we're going to save that for next week.
Yes. We're going to go full in on Pain and Glory next time.
But you did see, and we're not going to wait on this one because I'm just going to see it when it comes on Netflix.
Okay.
My name is Dolomite.
No, Dolomite is my name.
Dolomite is my name. Sorry.
Yes.
Does that open theatrically this weekend?
It is playing theatrically this weekend. Right. And it's for a couple of weeks, and then it's going to be... dropping on Netflix, and it is a delight. Screenwriters...
When on Netflix?
I want to say November 11th or something, but now you're asking me in midstream, and so I gotta go look it up. Yeah. But anyway, screenwriters Larry Karaszewski and Scott Alexander, they're the guys that did Ed Wood and People vs. Larry Flint and Big Eyes, so they, you know... They have a lane in the pop culture, which is basically sort of like, you know, outsiders who have a dream and make good. October 25th, so in 3 weeks.
Okay.
And their outsider this time is Rudy Ray Moore, played by Eddie Murphy in a return to form performance. Like, he's extraordinary in this movie, and funny and charming, and all the things that you've missed in an Eddie Murphy performance in the 10 years since Dreamgirls.
Right.
When we meet Rudy Ray Moore, he is sort of this struggling showbiz wannabe, didn't make it as a singer, didn't make it as a comedian, trying to sort of get a toehold in. He's working as the manager of a record store whose DJ, played by Snoop Dogg, won't even play his dance records. And there is this like old, what they used to call wino, who comes into the store periodically and starts spinning these kind of, you know, tall tale, urban legend-y, rhyming stories about a guy named Dolomite.
Right.
And Rudy Ray Moore eventually figures out, you know, all these old guys have these stories. I'm going to start... plying them with booze, writing them all down, and I'm going to build an act out of it, which everybody thinks is nuts. But he creates this Dolomite character as this like big flashy pimp and like, you know, ish talker and, you know, just sort of larger than life character. And the stand up takes off. He starts recording. He records a live album in his own living room and is selling the record out of the trunk of his car. And it's doing really well. A label notices and picks him up. You know, he's touring. He's hitting the success. And then he and his closest friends, who are played by Titus Burris, Mike Epps, and Craig Robinson, go to see on I think it's on Christmas night. They go to the Orpheum to see the 1974 remake of The Front Page, with Matthau and Lemon,
right?
And are completely bored,
right?
And are like, this movie has no laughs, no kung fu, no euphemism for breasts.
Okay.
You know, I'm going to make a Dolomite movie. I got to make a Dolomite movie. Well, no one is interested, not even American International Pictures, who were making, you know, Scream Blackula Scream and whatnot at the time. And so he puts like all of his money and all of his record royalties and everything on the line to get this movie made. He hires this, they meet an actor played by Wesley Snipes, who is hysterically funny. It's like the one sort of quasi legitimate Hollywood connection they have to direct the film. Even though it turns out he doesn't really know what he's doing, they wind up relying on these like UCLA film students led by Cody Smith McPhee, who actually understand like lighting and cameras and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, so it's just the kind of the uphill climb of Rudy Ray Moore and Dolomite becoming this indie film phenomenon. And it's just really funny and charming. It's directed by Craig Brewer, who did the Footloose remake and Black Snake Moan and Hustle and Flow. You know, I just, as somebody said, it is the most charming movie you'll ever see that says MF-er 375 times. it's really delightful.
I can say that word that many times in one day.
Quite easily, yes. Divine Joy Randolph, who's currently on Becoming a God in Central Florida, plays this woman named Lady Reed, who Rudy Ray Moore meets and sort of like becomes her mentor, and she also becomes a comedian, and she's in Dolomite. And Ruthie Carter, who did the costumes for Black Panther, does all the outfits. So there's like just amazing 70s outfits from the like blatantly cartoonish stuff that they use for the movie or that he does for the stage act, to just the sort of like the day to day, you know, kind of 70s look that people would have. It's a lot of fun. I think you're really going to enjoy it.
I'm ready.
I don't know if The New Beverly fits on your list of movies with chairs you like. I don't think it does.
Currently, no. I love The New Beverly.
Yes.
Not in this lower back sciatica economy.
Because this week they're screening Dolomite Is My Name in 35 in double features with the original Rudy Ray Moore Dolomite.
I'm sure it's
movies.
Streaming. I'm sure the Dolomite they are.
There's at least the first Dolomite is on Amazon. I totally plan to rent it because now that I've seen,
never seen any of them.
Me neither.
So I would love to.
But
see, before I see,
once
this
you
new
see
one,
Dolomite Is My Name, you're like, oh my god, I have to see this movie.
So,
yes.
You got a DVD you like this week?
I was thinking about.
Say DVD. I mean, you know,
streaming, whatever.
Any home viewing film, yes.
We always tend to forget this in the Karaszewski Alexander oeuvre, but it definitely sort of fits into their theme of, you know, show business outsiders with a crazy dream.
Yeah.
Man in the Moon, rather. The Andy Kaufman movie with
Milos Forman.
Yes, Jim Carrey and Courtney Love. I think, you know, not to be forgotten. Also very funny and also uniquely eccentric, and I think captures the sort of weirdness of Kaufman in an appropriate way. And I think Jim Carrey at that point in his career was the perfect guy to play him. And I think Carrey these days sort of seems to be off in Kaufman orbits of his own. I don't know.
It seems like it.
Yeah. But it's a good movie and people should check it out. What do you got?
A 2006 documentary, or was it 2005? The Devil and Daniel Johnston.
Oh, yes.
Documentary about the late singer-songwriter Daniel Johnston and his struggles in life, and about the wonderfulness of his music, and about the care that you know, his fans and the people around him showed him. Always felt very protective. I personally always felt very protective of him. Mm-hmm. Loved him from the 80s until now.
Passed away recently.
And he died recently. And the reason I bring this up is because a whole lot of good musicians are dying in 2019, and it's freaking me out a little bit. Daniel Johnston died. Roky Erickson of the 13th Floor Elevators died. Scott Walker of the Walker Brothers, and then of Scott Walker,
right,
died. David Berman of the Silver Juice, and just this week, Kim Shattuck from the Muffs
and died. Ginger Baker
of ALS. I respect Ginger Baker. I don't have feelings for Ginger Baker.
Fair enough.
If that makes sense.
No, I get you.
I have feelings for all these other people.
Sure, I understand.
Kim Shattuck died young. She was in her 50s, and she had ALS. And if you don't know the Muffs, they were just this cool pop punk band, and she was good, you know? And it's all 2019. This is all happening in 2019, and it's bothering me.
Well, we're getting older, Dave White. Our cultural peers are gonna, you know.
I know.
We also lost the great Diane Carroll this week, who was a pioneer and also a great singer. She introduced the song "Sleepin' Bee" on Broadway, which was later recorded by Barbara Streisand, I think, on her first album.
Yes.
And I just during a break during this program, I found out that Rip Taylor died
just today.
Yes.
Yeah.
A memorable one of a kind comedian,
a wild queer comedian.
Yes.
Of, the 60s and 70s.
And also was in all the Jackass.
And he was in all the Jackass movies too. He was great. And our neighbor?
Yeah, I know. We always saw his
photo see him
on
around.
The wall of stuff.
Yeah.
By the way, I got it wrong for it. Man on the Moon is the name of the movie. I always get it confused with the Reese Witherspoon film The Man in the Moon. But it's named for the R.E.M. song, Man on the Moon.
Would you like to feel the love tonight?
Or in the afternoon, like in the remake?
I have 5-star reviews to read you.
Oh, yay!
Karina L.S. says, this is long overdue. You know what? Grandpa's got to put his reading glasses on. Hang on.
Go through this every time.
This is long overdue for me to write a review for Linoleum Knife, as I've been listening to their movie reviews podcast for a few years now. Partly because I'm a terrible writer, don't want to write a terrible review, but in short, they are fabulous.
Oh.
Well-informed and witty. I first discovered them when I watched What the Flick, now called Breakfast All Day, with Alonzo Duralde, and wondered what his Linoleum Knife shirt meant. Luckily, that was a podcast with fellow critic and husband, Dave White. They cover not only the big-budget movies, but smaller movies and films that I wouldn't have known about them, that I wouldn't have known about without them. I'm glad that I now do. I'm grateful for their dedication to film in all of its forms and their cute married banter.
Well, thank you very much.
That's what we are. Cute and married. Cute first. Cuteness is always first.
Always cute. Always first.
The Mad J Woman says, imagine this, a married couple where you actually like and want to be around both of them. Now, thank you. Now imagine, did I already read this on the air? Are you sure I didn't already read this one on the air?
I'm not sure.
All right, I'm just going to, listen, if I read it before, I'm going to read it again.
Okay.
I don't remember, but a cozy chat, you'll feel like you're with a friend at the other end of the table while they debate the latest cinema offerings. Perfect pod for anyone looking to expand their viewing selection and film knowledge. They cover all movies, from blockbusters to art house, with equal measure also recommending older titles to seek, lest you assume all critics are fusty.
Ooh.
Yeah. Their cultural leanings are deep and diverse. Alonzo's film theory insights extend from classics to Christmas and kaiju. Dave White can speak in depth on high art as well as punk rock.
You.
Listen, you're right about all of this. And everybody got to know.
I'm going to continue reading the letter now.
Yes.
The review now.
Won't you?
Their recommendations have taken me far afield of my pop culture comfort zone. Quite literally traveling to new indie theaters hours away. Oh, wow. My God. But I've yet to be led astray. If you want more, the LK Podiverse has more culture to comment upon on Patreon. Oh, look, here's our Patreon ad written for us. They offer plenty of interaction with engaged listeners there. And on social media, they can also hip you to other culture critics, many of whom pop by now and again. My only complaint: this podcast is not to be listened to on an empty stomach. Digressions frequently revolve around an equally diverse amount of food talk. Be it Dave White's culinary wizardry. That's right.
You're a wizard.
I don't have to live under the stairs anymore. I went to the wizard school. I'm a culinary wizard. Just tell that to the Instant Pot. My cupboards are overly stocked with box cake, thanks to a musing earlier this year, and I still haven't entirely forgiven them. Thank you, Mad J Woman.
Thank you so much. And yes, we do have a Patreon at patreon.com/linoleumknife, where we offer extra shows like LKTV, a podcast of the television, Linoleum Knife and Fork, a food podcast hosted by two film critics, and Linoleum Nights, where we talk about current events and trailers and all kinds of different stuff. Also, there's tangible goodies like t-shirts and mugs and Christmas ornaments and enamel pins, but intangible ones like club meetings and private personalized podcasts and stuff like that. So check us out at patreon.com/linoleumknife. And hey, we're going to read letters this time for the first time in ages, because we don't have a guest for once.
We're finally going to read those Adam letters that we've been talking about.
We asked for trans listeners to let us know their thoughts, and they did.
Yeah. This is regarding the film Adam, which is a strange and not good movie about a young heterosexual cisgender teenage boy who falls in love with a young lesbian. And when she assumes that he is transgender,
does not correct her.
He does not correct her. Problems ensue.
Yes.
Both narratively and
thematically.
Thematically,
yes.
All right, so this is from Name Withheld.
Yes.
First name, name. Last name withheld. Of the Baltimore withheld.
Yeah.
This is our second take on this letter, because the first thing I did was they say, this letter is from blah name. And then two sentences in, they say, hey, please don't mention my name. So, starting over. Hi, Alonzo and Dave. My movie critic, Gunkles.
Oh.
This is a bit of a saga, so I doubt it'll be read on the show. Oh, you thought wrong. How about that? I'm a longtime listener to the whole LK suite.
Oh.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. And a huge fan. I also happen to be a trans person in entertainment.
Oh.
I was so hoping you would review Adam, and after listening to the episode where you did, I felt that I had to write in. I was already familiar with the novel, which, if you thought the movie was bad, in terms of consequences for Adam and his behavior, the book is far worse. For example, when Ethan, the trans friend, learns about Adam's deceit, he not only laughs, but eggs him on and encourages him to share more details. Beyond that, I knew of Ariel Schrag's work on the original The L Word, and I understand that the series was invaluable for many lesbian and bisexual women, but as a trans man who was doing a lot of questioning at the time, the Max Sweeney storyline was personally damaging. Oh my. Matt, listen, that Max character on The L Word, they had no idea how to handle how to handle that character, but they didn't stop trying.
Nope.
They kept going. Just it was
forged right ahead.
Yeah. I felt and still feel that trans narratives aren't Ms. Schrag's to tell. Mm. So when I heard that her novel was being adapted into a movie,
I had zero reason to want to see it. Still, I have met and worked with Reese Ernst and wanted to support work by a trans filmmaker. Honestly, that's why I went to see it, too.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, gotta go. Gotta go do this. Gotta go see this movie. I have also several friends in the cast and crew, many of whom are making their film debut, and I want to support them, too. So, already knowing what the movie was going to be about, I went in with middling expectations. I also saw the film with my partner, who is a cis man, because I had a feeling he would perceive the movie differently. As you mentioned in your review, even though it is set in the recent past of 2006, Adam is very much a period piece. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It is. Not just in the events that unfold, but in the language these characters use and the conversations they have. Some of these terms would be derided now for being outdated and offensive, but that's just how we used to talk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Little interruption there. Remember how Christian Siriano...
I was just thinking of that exact
on Project Runway thing. Would just throw the T-word around
oh, yeah.
all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And this was about 2006-ish. You know,
I guess, yeah.
And everyone thought it was adorable,
mm-hmm.
and he was very comfortable doing it. You know, had you know many trans friends, and even as late as the Caitlyn Jenner reality show, you had people like not Jenny Boylan, but I'm blanking on her name.
I know who you mean. Theorist.
Yes. Kate Bornstein. Thank you, memory. Kate Bornstein saying how she continues to use that word and doesn't want anybody bothering her about it.
Mm.
A trans pioneer.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's been 15 years ish.
Yeah.
And that word is now not one that you say at all.
Unless you are in the community.
Unless you're Kate Bornstein.
Yeah. That too.
So anyway, in fact, here I'm continuing with the letter now. I'm not just yapping on my own. In fact, some of these conversations felt so real they were funny. There's a scene in which a trans guy asks Adam, who did his top? To which Adam responds, Garamore. At the time, surgeons who specialized in top surgery were so few and far between that if a trans guy encountered another trans guy who had had top surgery, it wasn't offensive to publicly ask him where he had it done. There are some big names in top surgery, of which Garamore and Brownstein, who was also mentioned, is one. All of that to say, the film does succeed in giving you an overall mid-zeros, mid-aughts, mid-oohs, trans vibe, if that's a thing. Unfortunately, the trans people in this movie just kind of swirl around Adam without any of them being fully realized characters. They're all just sound bites, again, for how trans people talked to each other at the time. Adam is a tourist in their world, and the audience only gets to see trans people as he sees them. They drift in and out for him, giving him little nuggets of information that he uses to manipulate the character of Jillian.
Mm.
I don't even think at the end that he comes away having learned anything about the people he spent his summer with at all, trans or not. No, the movie gives you no indication that he has learned a valuable lesson.
So
not 1 minute.
So it wasn't the summer that changed everything.
No, not at all. He just enjoyed a brief stay in their little queer ecosystem and is going to go back home totally unchanged. At least that is what it feels like. When my partner and I left the theater, his immediate reaction was, I don't know what I was supposed to learn from that. Maybe the answer is nothing. Maybe this is a trans movie that just gets to be a trans movie. But since we're living in a time of increased visibility for trans rights and issues, we can't ignore that some cis people will come to this movie expecting to learn something about trans people. In that sense, by depicting a cis straight character who takes advantage of people across the LGBTQ+ spectrum with impunity, Adam is being irresponsible in its messaging. Every character in this movie is unlikable. I can't empathize or side with Adam, but I also cannot side with his sister, whose stance on trans issues is whatever gets trans people to have sex with me. That's true. The character is very much like, she she has a sort of awakening about sex with a trans person, and that becomes her, for lack of a better word, her fetish.
I see.
Yeah. Even though she identifies as queer, she and Adam essentially take the same approach to getting other people to have sex with him, and it is equally repulsive. I can't side with Ethan, who lays into Adam about how effed up his actions are, only to immediately forgive him. And everyone else is sadly too one-dimensional to care for. Without anyone to really latch onto, the film is really difficult to engage with. And then, as you mentioned in your review, there are zero consequences for anyone in the movie. During what I assume was the climax of the film, the confrontation scene between Adam's sister, his friend from school, and Ethan over the death of a trans woman, at no point does Adam use any of the information he has gleaned from trans characters to stand up to his friend and advocate for the community that he has been preying on all summer long. Not only does Ethan forgive him, as previously discussed, but Jillian even goes on to shift the blame from Adam to herself for knowing that he was cis, but going along with it anyway. When June finds out that Adam has been pursuing Jillian, she almost encourages him to follow his heart. The only consequence is that he doesn't get to see Jillian anymore. But since he was only there for the summer, that would have happened anyway. I'm laughing because it's true.
Yikes.
Even after all that, my partner and I couldn't stop talking about what it means for a cis person to be masquerading as a trans person. Often, an argument made by anti-trans bigots is that trans people are deceiving cis people, pretending to be another gender so that we can gain access to spaces. For example, the claim that trans women are trying to get access to public bathrooms to assault cis women and girls. The reality is that trans people are only trying to get equal access to such facilities, and that often we are more likely to be the targets of harassment, discrimination, and violence simply for existing. Not only that, but rather than trans people feigning a certain gender to gain access, there are actual documented cases of cis people pretending to be trans in order to do that very thing. The most famous example is probably Laura Albert / J.T. LeRoy. Oh, don't I know it.
That's a story for another day.
Oh, it's a story that's already been told on this podcast.
I know. I just didn't want to go down that rabbit hole right now.
My phone call interviews with J.T. LeRoy and the many, many special moments we shared where young J.T. would give me a call and be like, "Hey, Dave, how's it going? I hear you want to interview me for this magazine.
Stop.
Blah, 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 blah. lie.
We were part of a cultural moment.
We were. But it happened again. I'm now going back to the letter. But it happened again pretty recently where a Fenty model pretended to be trans in an attempt to dodge criticism about some transphobic remarks that she had made in the past.
Oh.
I didn't hear about that. We were debating whether or not the film effectively spins this trope on its head. Unfortunately, I don't think the film is self-aware enough to do this very well. I don't think cis folks are going to come away understanding the fallacy of this trans deceit argument. I don't think they're going to come away caring for the trans characters in this film at all. Now, all that being said, I do believe this film has every right to exist. In addition to working in entertainment, I'm also a judge for a literary award given to playwrights. Often, when reviewing a play that is written by playwrights of a marginalized identity, be they people of color, LGBTQ identified, people with disabilities, etc., there will be panelists who pick it apart by comparing it to similar plays. Inevitably, someone has to remind the group that while we can count the number of plays about, insert identity, on one hand, there are endless plays about an upper-middle-class white family fighting about first-world problems in their living room. For too long, we've given cis white men more than enough access to try and fail, to succeed, or even to just be average. I mean, seriously, this podcast. What are we doing? This podcast.
I like to think of us as slightly above average.
We're medium okay.
Yeah.
For a couple of queers.
Yeah.
I'm now going to continue with the letter.
Please do.
Name withheld. First of all, you write very well.
Yes.
Secondly, you write a lot. I'm very excited to continue reading this letter. They continue. Everyone else is expected to work twice as hard for half as much.
Yeah.
That's the truth. I don't think Adam is a good movie. I'm not even talking about it. I'm not even talking about its supposed message. I'm saying it's not a well-made film. That's true. But I think as far as works by and for trans people, it needs to be allowed to exist, and it has to be allowed to suck. I think it is
equal access to
equal access to being rotten. I think it is messy and irresponsible, but at the end of the day, I know a lot of trans people who were employed thanks to this movie.
Indeed.
In an industry that consistently thinks we are not talented enough to portray our own community, that is saying something. In order to build a trans film canon, we need to have a big enough body of work that there are winners and duds. And yes. Honestly, I would take an absolute dud of a movie created by and for trans people over a dumpster fire produced by and starring Scarlett Johansson.
To randomly pluck a name out of the ether.
That's a hypothetical example. Yes. Sorry about this email being so long. No.
No.
I would read a letter from you every week. Name withheld. Maybe Adam, for all its faults, does have one thing going for it. It's providing some much-needed discussions in and about queer cinema. Thank you for reading. I look forward to your next episode. Sincerely, Name Withheld.
I looked it up. Christian Siriano's season of Project Runway ended in 2008.
Okay. Well, yeah.
And I still remember the SNL sketch where Amy Poehler plays him.
Yes.
And says the word.
Yeah. Oh, that word is in my book.
Oh, I think it's in mine, too.
That came out in 2006.
One. Yeah, I think it's in my 2005 one.
And
this is just how we were.
Listen, the trans people I knew in 2006 were using that word. And so, like, I look back now. When I recorded the audio version of my book, I was like, oh, my God. Why is that word? Who was I? Why is that word in that book? And it's in it like three times, all in one paragraph. Mm. But like, I had to chop that right out.
Yeah, no. If I ever get around to actually like creating a Kindle or something for
a second edition,
for my first book, out that word goes.
We did not know we were wrong.
No.
We learned.
Yes.
That's the letter. That's a fantastic letter.
Yes, it is.
All right.
We have another Adam letter that we will read on a future episode and some other... Actually, we have quite the backlog of
mail. We always say, hey, let's do an all-letters
episode. I keep threading an all-letters episode. But we appreciate the letters nonetheless, and we will do our best to get caught up. So thank you for that. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Go to the Bibbs and Whitney or launching a whole new podcast network called Critically Acclaimed with all of their great shows. Yeah, Critically Acclaimed and Canceled Too Soon and Simply the Best. I would say the one where they do all the Best Picture nominees, which is a very ambitious slate. Anyway, go look for all their stuff because they're amazing.
I don't remember.
The Schmoes Know, of course, and Dennis Enun with Dennis Hensley. The Comics Canon, Seriously Timid. Sorry, did I say that? I'm my list is all over the place.
Why
in my
is
head
your brain
today.
Not working properly?
I don't know. Deck the Hallmark, Sewers of Paris, Comics Canon. I said the Fat Guys, the movies, the Criterion cast. You can again leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We will read that sucker on the air, and you can subscribe for free there. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio and Spotify and Google Play, Castbox, Podbean, you name it. Follow us at BFast all day. Sorry, I'm getting
this
my show
breakfast
confused.
All day.
It is not.
Do you know who you are anymore?
I don't. Follow us at Linoleum Cast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Lots of exciting things coming up. And if you are in Edison, New Jersey.
Oh, yes.
On the second weekend of April, November, the 8th, 9th.
What month is it even?
I don't know. I don't smell burning toast. November 8th, 9th, and 10th, the first annual Christmas Con is happening, and they are trucking in all of your Hallmark favorites.
Lacey, I don't have any.
Lacey Chabert.
I have no Hallmark favorites.
And
what's in it for
Witt
me?
And Nikki DeLoach and Jack
Kay. I guess I'm just staying
and
home.
Chad Michael Murray and Cameron Matheson. I'm going to be moderating a podcast panel with our good friends Dan Bran and Panda from Deck the Hallmark, as well as Tim from Can't Wait for Christmas and Brian from Christmas Past. It's going to be a thing. You don't want to miss it. Check it out.
Christmas sausage party.
More information at That's For Entertainment, THATS number 4, entertainment.com. And again, ovid.tv, OVID.TV. Use the term podcast as your code and get 50% off the first 3 months. Thank you all for being here. We'll catch you next time. And until then,
goodbye.